they get out of the park unharmed? They did. They were right beside me. I left them to come here, and they went on to seek refuge at the temple.
The temple, Katarine murmurs. Good.
No doubt many sought refuge there. Most of the city would flee toward it. Perhaps on the way they would stop by the hotel with torches and raised fists. They would have a good enough reason. She wanders away from the group, back toward the window. The area surrounding the festival grounds is quiet now, deserted, but the rest of the city seethes with frightened activity. She feels Peter's hands on her shoulders.
Do you know what this is, Kat? Do you know what it wants?
No, Peter. She shakes her head miserably.
Do they?
At the mention of the dead queens, she jerks loose and darts a glance of warning between him and the nearby ears of the council.
If they do, they have not told me.
They have not told her, but they are racing through her blood like spooked fish. They make it impossible to think, impossible to stand still.
What must be done?
She holds her hands out to Genevieve, to Luca. She turns to Antonin and Renata and even Bree. But no one answers. Finally, Katarine clenches her fists and shrieks,
What must be done?
We do not know.
Luca scrunches her wizened old shoulders.
You may as well ask the heir, or the goddess. Nothing like this has happened within our lifetimes. Nothing like this has ever happened before.
Katarine stares at the floor. As she dressed that morning, she had not noticed the pattern of the rug beneath her feet. It is a weaving of Queen Ilion, the Blue Queen, standing atop the black basalt cliffs, with her arms outstretched and black hair billowing like a cloud. In the sea, the mainland ships wreck against her waves, and between them, the mist rises like a shroud. Katarine glares at it. It is as though she is being mocked by the mist's very creator.
Is this where it happened? Here, on Shannon's Blackway? Was the mist created here?
She turns on Genevieve.
If it was, you should have known, and we should never have come to Roland.
Battles were fought up and down the coast, Genevieve stammers. But the mist was created at Barden Harbor, not here. She is depicted here, perhaps because she was an elemental.
And you have learned nothing else? About her? About this?
She gestures to the mist in the weaving, but Genevieve shakes her head. It is all legend, another ancient secret that the island keeps. Katarine frowns. She wills the dead queens to help her, to guide her. But they remain agitated and silent.
Get reports, she says finally. Find out who is missing. Take accounts from those the mist touched but did not harm. Peter, Renata, and...
She searches their faces.
Bree, we'll do this. The people of Roland will speak to her and to you, if you are with her.
She nods to Antonin.
Antonin, take the Queen's Guard back to the park. Secure it, and then disperse soldiers through the city to provide aid.
Yes, Queen Katarine.
They go without complaint, relieved to have a task.
And what of us?
Genevieve looks between herself and Luca. Katarine strips off the pretty lace gloves that the Westwoods gave her. She tears the black pearls off over her head and squeezes them between her fingers.
Genevieve, I need you to send for an oracle.
An oracle?
Write to Sunpool. Tell them to send their best, their most gifted. Tell them if they can offer an insight into the mist, they will have a seat on the Black Council as their reward.
A council seat?
Genevieve blinks.
Are you sure? Just do it!
Right away, Queen Katarine.
She leaves and closes the door softly behind her. Catherine looks at Luca and pours a glass of tainted brandy.
You must be thrilled. My reign is going so poorly.
I would be, says Luca as Catherine drinks, if it were going poorly only for you.
Catherine snorts. Well then, what can the temple do to help?
The temple is full of old scholars.
We can comb the libraries and the histories, see what we can find.
She steps up beside the queen and knocks their cups together.
And we can pray.
The Road from Bastion City. By the time Jules, Emilia, and Mathilde leave the village, heading north along the foothills of the Sea Watch Mountains, the mood at the inn has changed. After that first night, when they saw Jules guide the knives and saw Camden leap across tables so fiercely, they began to look at her with awe. So much awe that when they bid farewell to the innkeeper, Jules is almost sure the girl will bow. Though in the end, all she does is a hasty curtsy.
We'll spread the word, the girl says, and we'll be ready when you call.
She holds out a parcel, and Camden sniffs the air.
May I?
She asks, and Jules nods. The girl unwraps the fish and lets Camden take it gently between her teeth.
Farewell,
she says.
Farewell.
For now, says Amelia, and they walk on.
Jules watches Camden up the road, where she is laying down to tear at the fish and purr. Reminds me of how it was in Wolf Spring, when Arsinoe had her bear. We couldn't walk into a pub without someone shoving a trout into our arms.
Get used to it, says Amelia.
It is better, is it not? Having them feed your cat instead of spit in your hair for the curse?
It is. The looks on their faces when they saw her use her gifts, both of them. Not disgust or even fear, only hope. All thanks to a silly prophecy and a couple of bards who could carry a fine tune. Still, it felt good. More than that, it had started to feel right. They pass through three more towns on the road north, and in every village Amelia and Mathilde find ears willing to listen. They meet in secret, in taverns and country houses, in dark dusty barns and beside the soft banks of rivers. The people come carrying pitchforks and shovels as though they would be weapons. They see the warrior who has a cougar familiar, and they start to believe.
What did I tell you? Amelia says, turning the roasting rabbit on the spit above their campfire as Camden's mouth waters.
They believe. They want change as badly as we do.
But can we win? Jules turns her own rabbit, a much larger and meatier one than Amelia's. With an army of farmers and fishers and all of different gifts? They aren't soldiers, and they're as like to fight one another as they are to fight the Queen's Guard.
We can win, says Mathilde. With enough of the island at our back, we can win.
In the back of her mind, Jules hears the whisper that the queens are sacred. But she stamps out the thought. Queens are sacred, but these poisoner queens have failed them. They have corrupted the line, especially Catherine.
You should go easier on the exaggerations next time, Mathilde, Amelia says.
But across the flames, the seer only grins.
Why? The crowds love to hear the grand tales. The grander, the better. So what, if Jules did not really kill 50 soldiers during the escape from the Volroy cells? So what if her war gift cannot halt 100 arrows?
Nothing, as long as they never want a demonstration, Jules says, and Amelia laughs.
You and the other bards are going to make people think I'm 12 feet tall.
Mathilde chuckles and tears a small loaf of bread into four chunks. She tosses them one each, and Jules takes up Camden's share to press against the side of the rabbit to soak up the juices.
That is the last of the bread, Mathilde says.
We will have to go without for a few days. There is nothing between us and the foot of the mountain now. Nothing, unless they turn south and make for the glen and the black cottage. Jules strips off a piece of meat and chews it as she snaps off a quarter haunch for Camden. It is not enough for the cougar. They will have to hunt again before dusk. But with her gift, game is easy to find. This sweet rabbit practically hopped into her arms. Up! Amelia stands and nudges Jules with her foot. Time to train. You are right about one thing. If we are to carry this off, you must truly look like a better warrior than I am. Jules pats Camden on the head and tells her to stay near the fire. If the big cat comes along, she will only wind up pinning Amelia to the cold ground. They find a small clearing in the trees, and Amelia tosses her a sword. Jules has graduated from the bluntness of sparring sticks. How much time will we need to train the soldiers? Jules asks as their blades cross.
More than we have.
But, Jules parries, we can't send farmers against armored Queen's Guard, not without the right training.
We can with the right leader. Now pay attention or I'm going to slice off your arm.
They cross blades again. Attack and parry. Nothing fancy, no flair, no heart.
But you are right about one thing. They are farmers, tradespeople. They are not soldiers, and many of them will die.
But why? If we wait?
Because people die in war.
Amelia advances in a flurry.
They die for what is right, and if you are to lead them, you'll have to let go of your naturalist weakness.
Jules thrusts her palm into Amelia's belly. Her war gift sends Amelia flying into a tree and knocks the wind right out of her.
Oh!
Jules runs to her and kneels.
I didn't mean for you to hit the tree.
It's all right.
Amelia takes Jules's hand and kisses the knuckles.
I kind of liked it.
At the edge of the clearing, Camden grunts.
Cam? I told you to stay with Mathilde.
The cat grunts again and twitches her tail irritably. When she turns and dashes back the way she came, Jules knows well enough to follow. At first it seems that nothing is amiss. Mathilde is seated before the fire, nearly as they left her. It is not until Camden puts a paw up onto Mathilde's shoulder that they see. The seer is stiff with a vision.
Mathilde?
Jules approaches cautiously. Amelia, what do we do?
Do not disturb her.
The warrior squats low and quickly moves nearby weapons and rocks.
When she comes out of it, she may jerk. Keep her from running into the flames and keep her from falling and striking her head.
She makes it sound worse than it is. When the vision is over, Mathilde simply twitches and blinks. Then a thin rivulet of blood leaks from her nose.
Here.
Amelia presses a wad of cloth to it.
Are you all right?
Jules asks.
I am fine. Did it last for long?
Not long. Camden told us to come back, and then it was only a few minutes. Mathilde sniffs and reaches out to scratch Camden behind the ears.
Good cat.
She dabs at the blood. It has already stopped.
What did you see? Asks Amelia.
Mathilde turns to Jules, her eyes large and sorrowful.
I think I saw your mother.
I think she is in danger, at the Black Cottage. After Mathilde's vision, Jules and Amelia wasted no time breaking camp and making their way toward the Black Cottage. The travel was slow in the dark, and by sunrise, their legs are too weary to increase the pace by much.
Perhaps she was wrong, Amelia says.
Or perhaps the vision wants us to go to the Black Cottage for some other purpose and is trying to lure us there.
Jules glances at Mathilde, who avoids her eyes. Behind her, Camden swings her tail back and forth, swatting Amelia in the legs. It seems an age that they travel along in silence. Another uncomfortable night's camp in the mountains, and another morning of walking, before the smoke from the black cottage chimney rises into view. Jules looks down across the meadow at the dark, pitched roofs, the crossed timbering. The door to the stable is open, and a small flock of chickens meanders around near the stream. Nothing seems out of sorts.
We may not be welcome here, Jules warns them. Old Willa might try to toss us out on our ears.
Old Willa, Amelia grins. Sounds like I'll like her. They walk on, out of the trees, and a large black crow dives from the branches. It flaps its wings hard in Mathilde's face and caws loudly into Camden's.
Aria!
Jules holds her hand out to her companions to keep them from harming the bird.
You know this bird? Mathilde asks.
She's my mother's.
They hurry across the grass, already brown from hard frosts, and Jules leaps up the cottage steps, casting an eye toward the crow perched atop the roof's edge.
Wait here, she says,
and she and Camden go inside alone. Instantly, Kara's brown hound, Juniper, barrels into Camden's side and licks her face. Kara comes to the door, and Jules walks into her arms.
I hope you don't mean to lick my face like that.
Your cougar doesn't seem to mind, Kara says, and chuckles. She draws back, holds Jules at arm's length. She studies every inch of her, from the tips of her toes to the ends of her cut brown hair. The tightness of her fingers speaks of how badly she wants to pull Jules close.
What are you doing here?
Madrigal, Jules says quickly. We saw Aria, and my friend, she nods to Mathilde, had a vision. Is she here? Is she safe?
Kara nods at Juniper, and the hound stops frantically pawing at Camden. Then she sighs. She is lovely, as always, even in an apron and her brown gold hair tied messily with a piece of twine. But her eyes are heavy.
Pesky crow, she says softly.
Always flying off places. She flapped around happily and then tried to peck my eyes out, just like Madrigal would have done.
Where is she?
A shadow crosses her aunt's face.
Let's go and see her.
She will want to hear all your news. Juniper will sit with your friends to make sure that Willa does not chase them off with a pitchfork when she returns from the barn. Quietly, Jules follows her aunt past the drawing room and the kitchen, down the long hall, to the same room where Arsinoe recovered from the bolt that Catherine shot into her back. Madrigal is in the bed. That alone is a strange enough sight. Though Madrigal was lazy about many things, she never overslept or lingered under blankets. She wanted too much of the world to lose 1 minute of daylight. But even more of a shock is how small she looks, lessened by the sheer size of her belly, pregnant with a child by Matthew Sandrin, Joseph's older brother.
Madrigal, what are you doing here?
Her mother pushes against her pillows, and Kara moves past Jules to help, sitting her up and slipping another pillow behind her back. The uncharacteristically sisterly gesture makes Jules go cold.
I could ask you the same.
Madrigal pats the quilt, and Jules goes closer.
Return to the island, and no word? When did you get back? Where have you been?
I actually never left. I've been in Bastion City with the warriors.
You could have gotten a message to us.
Madrigal pauses at a tapping. Aria the crow is at the window, and Kara goes to let the bird in. She flies once around the room and lands on the top corner bedpost.
I didn't want to make any more trouble for Grandma Kate and Ellis. I figured they had enough on their hands just dealing with my reputation.
Liar. You know your grandparents can handle that and more.
They're worried. They're wondering. The fields are terrible, and Luke? When poor Luke heard the rumors about the Legion Queen, he wept.
The rumors have reached you, then?
They have reached us.
But where is Arsinoe?
And Joseph, Billy, and the Elemental?
Jules shifts her weight to lean against Camden. Arsinoe, Billy, and Mirabella made it to the mainland. I guess that's where they are now. As for Joseph? She stops, and Madrigal places a hand atop her stomach. He's dead. But I think you probably guessed that.
He looked very bad when you left us by the river, says Kara. But I hoped.
I'm so sorry, Jules.
I'm sorry, too, adds Madrigal. He was a good boy.
He was more than that. But Jules clears her throat.
I'm sorry I made Luke cry. I guess I should have found a way to tell everyone.
Oh, Luke cries at the drop of a hat.
Madrigal waves her hand and wipes quickly at her eyes. She is pale, and that crow of hers is never so close by.
Now, what's wrong? Why are you in bed? I didn't think the baby would come until winter.
He won't, says Kara. Willa and I are making sure of it.
Jules glances around the room. It has a strange, stale smell she does not remember. And on the corner dresser is a tray of dirty cups and a plate of half-eaten root vegetables and greens.
Nettle leaf tea, Kara explains,
and fan root. If she eats it every day, it will ease the early contractions.
A waste of time, trying to hold this baby in. He won't come until he's ready, and he will be perfectly safe.
What do you mean? Jules asks.
Kara sighs. She has heard this tale many times before. Your mother saw a vision in a fire when she was dabbling with Arsinoe and her low magic.
At the bent-over tree, you mean?
Yes, Madrigal interrupts. I saw a vision in the fire that day. A fire stoked by Queen's blood in that sacred space. So I know it is true.
She pauses and looks at Jules, her face a mix of stubbornness and regret.
I saw my son, born alive, strong and red and screaming,
and sitting atop my dead gray corpse. The Mainland. Mirabella and Arsinoe sit together at a table in the quiet tea room. It is not the most popular establishment in the city. The biscuits are dry, and there are stains on the tablecloth. But at least they have some privacy, and do not have to be seated in some dark corner because Arsinoe still refuses to wear dresses. Since their encounter with Queen Ilion's shadow in the graveyard, they have had to find places besides the Chatworth House to talk. Billy's mother has been pushed to her limit, and on any day may try to put them out on the street.
I want to seek more low magic, Arsinoe says,
but Mirabella shakes her head and rubs the scab on her forearm.
No more.
She wants us to go back to the island. More low magic will only make her stronger.
You don't know that. You're just afraid. And so am I. But I can't take much more of these dreams. Every time I close my eyes, I'm someone else. I'm Daphne, and I'm tired.
You are curious, says Mirabella.
I see you, Arsinoe. You are more and more drawn into the dreams. Her bait is working.
The door to the shop opens, and Arsinoe glances toward the entrance. A woman and her two small children have come inside. Two little girls, holding hands and pointing at which biscuits they would like on the display.
After this is over, I would like to become a teacher, Mirabella says. I like children, though I have had little interaction with them.
Why would you? Arsinoe asks crossly. Queen's whelp babies, but we don't raise them.
Do not say whelp. Mirabella frowns. You know I hate it when you say whelp.
Whelp! That's not my problem.
Arsinoe crunches through a biscuit, slouched down so far that crumbs are able to fall directly into her collar.
Though, if you become a teacher, what would I do?
You could do the same.
I'd be a terrible teacher.
Only at first.
Arsinoe studies the children, so well-behaved, their brown hair in ringlets.
I'd rather make clothes or work in a pub.
I'm no use in a kitchen, but I can sew a little. Alice taught me how. And Luke.
Mirabella looks down at her hands. If you do the low magic again, I am afraid of what will happen. I am afraid we will lose all this.
All what?
Our lives. This future.
Arsinoe sees the way her sister looks at the children, with a kind of hopeful despair, the way someone looks at something they can never possibly have. What if there's something wrong on the island? Arsinoe asks.
Then let them sort it out, as they tried to sort us out, as they would again the moment we set foot back in that place.
Arsinoe sighs.
I have to find a way to stop the dreams, she whispers. Or solve them. I have to, or they will drive me mad.
But after that, she reaches across the table and takes Mirabella's hand. There will be time.
We can have a future here, I promise.
Mirabella does not respond, and Arsinoe leans back and slides down into her chair.
You promise, says Mirabella, except that it will never be over. Because the island is not something we can escape.
That night, Arsinoe fights sleep. For Mirabella and for Billy, she fights the dreams. She has her own life now, and if she wants to keep it, Mirabella is right. She has to let go of the island and make the dreams stop. She turns and peers through the darkness at her sister's still form. Mirabella makes not a peep when she sleeps. No moans, certainly no snoring. A queen through and through. And to think, Arsinoe once thought Mirabella would fart cyclones.
Mira, are you awake?
Arsinoe waits, but gets no response. She takes a deep breath and shuts her eyes. The dream begins, as they always do, nestled snug down inside Daphne's mind, seeing through Daphne's eyes, hearing through Daphne's ears. As the dream takes hold, and Arsinoe finds herself seated at a table in the Volroy, it is only the thought of Mirabella that allows her to keep her resolve. It would be so easy not to fight, to be Daphne for one more night, one more fortnight, another month, or to simply stay dreaming until her story ends. Except that the dreams have begun to feel less like an escape and more like a distraction, dulling her senses so she is oblivious as the axe swings down. In the dream, Daphne sits beside Richard, Daphne and Henry's pale, skinny friend from Centra, and glares up at the head table where Queen Ilion and Duke Brandon sit with their heads close together.
I do not understand it, Richard, Daphne says. There is no reason why Henry should lose. He has beaten all comers at the joust, at hawking and archery. He commands a ship even better than I do.
You see Henry differently, Richard replies.
What is that supposed to mean?
She takes a swallow of ale, good ale, not like Arsinoe has had on the mainland.
Anyone with two eyes can see that Henry is twice the man that rogue from Salcades is.
I believe that Henry is a match for any man, says Richard. But not every woman is a match for him.
Daphne peers up at Ilion. Neither she nor Arsinoe know what he is talking about. Ilion is a beauty. Such long black hair and soft, even features. Eyes as dark as Daphne's own, but wider, larger, and more thickly lashed.
How can you say that? She is lovely.
As Richard laughs, Arsinoe begins to squirm in Daphne's mind. It is not easy separating herself from the form she inhabits. It is actually so hard she would be sweating if only she had a body to sweat with.
Why are you laughing?
I always laugh when my friends are fools.
Daphne,
have you really never noticed the way that Henry looks at you? All those tavern girls back at Torrenside were a lie. All for show. For as long as I have known him, Henry has cared for only one girl above all the rest. You.
Finally, someone said it. The thing that had been obvious from the moment Arsinoe had started dreaming. And she pauses her struggle to free herself from the dream in order to watch.
That's not true, Daphne says. That's ridiculous.
Is it?
Richard shakes his head and chuckles again.
Yes, it is.
Daphne pushes away from the table and stalks out into the quiet corridor.
Get back in there. Sit down and listen.
But inside Daphne, Arsinoe feels the turmoil as the realization takes hold, as she remembers every interaction she and Henry have ever had, and begins to see them in a different way. The poor girl. Arsinoe wishes she had her own arms to pat her comfortingly on the back with.
Is something troubling you, Lady Daphne?
Daphne turns, and together she and Arsinoe narrow their eyes. Duke Brandon has made his way into the hall after them.
Not at all, my lord. I am only taking a little air. Please return to the queen and your meal.
She will wait.
He smiles lopsidedly. Such a handsome man. Even Arsinoe's intense dislike of him cannot completely override it.
Why do you never wear dresses?
He advances a step, then another.
You are a lovely enough thing.
On Fenburn, one can be lovely without the aid of a dress.
Arsinoe notices the shuffle in his stride. He has had too much wine. He's drunk far too often. Even Ilion cannot be blind to that. And nor is Daphne. Arsinoe feels alarm spike through her as the Duke moves closer, pushing her further into the shadowy corridor.
But you,
he says,
were raised in the civilized world, and so you should behave as a proper woman.
Proper?
Daphne asks.
Were you one of my sisters, I would have you whipped. Were you one of my serfs, I would have you burned.
Then it's a good thing I am neither.
Arsinoe's pulse quickens as she watches the Duke edge ever closer.
Get out of here, Daphne!
But she does not, and in two fast movements Brandon has them pinned against the wall. For a moment, Daphne is so shocked that she freezes, and inside her Arsinoe does the same. The feeling of Brandon's hands roaming beneath Daphne's tunic is so wrong and disgusting that it nearly causes Arsinoe to wake.
Do not touch me.
Why, it is no great secret what you have underneath. You have shown it to all, dressed as a man.
I thought you were pious,
Daphne objects,
and courteous to women.
Courtesy does not extend to whores.
Kill him. Kick him.
Inside Daphne's mind, Arsinoe tries to move her limbs, to bring her knee up hard in the place where it would pain him most. But she cannot make Daphne's body fight any more than she can stop the tears that blur their vision.
Daphne, are you all right?
Brandon moves away at the sound of Richard's voice.
I heard a bit of a scuffle.
Brandon glares between Richard and Daphne and back again before he laughs. He leaves the hall as quickly as he arrived. When he walks past Richard, he shoves the thin young man into the wall.
Sentrons,
he mutters.
Whores and weaklings.
In the dream, Daphne and Richard move to comfort each other, but Arsinoe balks.
No! Enough of this!
Anger at Brandon fuels her frustration with the dream. She twists and thrashes, screams so hard she must be screaming for real. Her attempt to break the dream will probably be thwarted not by the shadow of Queen Ilion, but by Mrs. Chatworth and Jane, shrieking in panic after she wakes the house. For a moment, her thrashing does not work, until she jerks her arm, and Daphne's arm jerks right along with it. That is all it takes. the dream goes dark.
Hello?
She can hear herself breathing. She looks down in the dark and sees that she is herself again, Arsinoe, right down to the scarred face and borrowed trousers. This is a dream of a different sort, but equally as vivid. She inhales and smells the familiar damp scent of Fenburn Earth.
Did I break the dream?
She wonders aloud.
Why didn't I wake? Can I wake?
Something in the shadows slides coolly past her shoulder, and she pedals backward, not caring that she cannot see the terrain. She knows that touch, even though she has never felt it. The shadow of the Blue Queen. Light breaks through, and Arsinoe blinks. They are on the island, in the clearing beside the bent-over tree.
Did you choose this place? Or did I?
The shadow of Queen Ilion stands before her, motionless. Then it puts a hand to its throat, points a thin finger, as it did that day next to Joseph's grave, as it has every time she has seen it.
Go to where you can speak, I know. But we are on the island now.
She stomps her foot against the dirt.
So spit it out.
It repeats the motion, more and more agitated, until it is shaking so hard that the crown of silver and blue shifts atop its head. It drags dark fingers across where its mouth would be.
Stop doing that!
Arsinoe shouts.
Just tell me what you want. Why am I dreaming through Daphne's eyes? Why won't you speak to my sister?
She sticks out her arm and bares the crescent scar.
She worked the same low magic as me. So why isn't she dreaming?
But no matter what she asks, the Blue Queen says nothing. Only continues the frustrating pantomime, throat, mouth, point.
Go to the island. But why do you want us to go there? What am I supposed to see?
The shadow stops. Then it points again, very slowly. Arsinoe turns. Above the trees of the Wolf Spring Meadow is the summit of Mount Horn, the great mountain of Fenburn that looks down upon Innisfool Valley and houses the Black Cottage at its base.
You can't really see that from here, Arsinoe says, and I should know.
The shadow claws at its mouth.
You mean the mountain?
The shadow relaxes and Arsinoe exhales.
You want me to go to Mount Horn? And what will I find there?
In answer, the Dark Queen slides toward her. She drags across the ground and across the half-submerged sacred stones. Arsinoe steps back until she feels the hanging branches of the bent-over tree. She does not know what she fears most, Queen Ilion or it. The Blue Queen draws closer. And as she comes, the darkness melts away at the edges until it is completely gone, and Arsinoe stands face to face with Daphne. Daphne? The Blue Queen?
Not Ilion!
Daphne?
It's been you the whole time? How? Why are you wearing Ilion's crown?
She smiles at her, a smile Arsinoe has only seen through a looking glass. She touches her mouth, shakes her head.
Right, right, you still can't speak.
Daphne cocks her head, and the dream shifts again, this time only a flash, a rush of colors. But it is all nightmare. Blood, and swords, and bodies rotting on the ground. Camden, with her fur stained red. Jewels.
Jewels!
She jerks awake and finds Mirabella and Billy leaned over her. Mirabella holding her shoulders while Billy holds a candle so close it is likely to singe her eyebrows.
Arsinoe?
Mirabella gasps.
What is it? Jewels.
Arsinoe swallows. The dream is still thick around her. She half expects to look into the corner and see Daphne standing there in Queen Ilion's crown.
Billy?
They hear his sister, Jane, call out from down the hall.
Is everything all right?
It's fine, Jane. Just a nightmare. Go back to sleep.
Arsinoe breaks away from him and swings her rubbery legs out of bed. It wasn't just a nightmare. It was a message.
What message? He asks. What did you see?
I saw Jules on a battlefield with Katarine.
A battlefield?
Mirabella's brow knits. The island has not seen a battlefield in 100 years. I know what I saw.
You do not have the sight gift.
I know what I saw, Arsinoe snaps.
All right, but it was still only a nightmare.
Billy and Mirabella exchange that look, the one she has come to hate, that says they are worried and she is losing her mind. If she tries to tell them now about Daphne, about the message, they will never believe her. Worse, they might try to stop her. So even though her heart is halfway into her throat, she forces herself to be calm. It felt very real, she says.
I'm sure that it did.
Was it like the other dreams you've had? Billy sets down the candle. He pours her a cup of water from the pitcher on her bedside table. No, not really. Arsinoe drinks down the water and runs her fingers through her hair. The dream of Jules felt like a warning, a consequence if she does not do what Daphne wants.
Are you going to be all right? Billy asks.
I guess so, she says.
Can you go back to sleep? We can talk more in the morning.
Arsinoe nods and begins to think of ways to pay for a boat back to the island. The Volroy. After the attack of the mist in Rolanth, Katarine and her court quickly returned to Indrid Down. No one, not even Antonin and Genevieve, who loved the capital as their own mother, really wanted to return. But there was nowhere else to go. They have still not found all of those who went missing, Katarine says, lying in Peter's arms in the safety of her rooms. How long will it take? Or does the mist mean to keep them? Peter kisses the top of her head.
I do not know, Kat. But whoever is found, and in whatever state, should be brought to the capital immediately. There are bound to be wild tales, and we will want to verify them.
We have to find a way to fight the mist, Peter. They think I am the cause of it. All the way back to the Volroy, they had been dogged by whispers and shifting eyes. The mist or the queen? The people cannot decide who they ought to fear most. But they have decided who to blame. Peter? She slides her fingertips between the buttons of his shirt to feel his heartbeat and the warmth of his skin. What if the mist is right?
What do you mean?
What if I am not supposed to be in the crown? What if it was not meant to be me and I stole it, like the people are saying? Peter props his head on his elbow, his ice blue eyes soft for once.
No one knows why the mist is doing this. When people are afraid, they grasp on to the easiest answer.
But what if it was supposed to be Mirabella? Or even, she makes a sour face, Arsinoe?
Then it would be them. The crown of Fenburn cannot be stolen. It must be won, and you won it.
By default, because I was the only one who wanted it. I am the queen because they abandoned us and allowed me to be.
That is right.
He brushes a lock of black hair from her neck.
You are the queen crowned because you fought when they did not. Because you would have killed them as a queen does. You are not the one who does not belong in the crown.
He looks down to her chest, to the center of her.
The dead queens. They are the ones who were never meant for it.
Do not start that again, Peter. They are the only reason I am anything. Without them, you would have killed me.
I know.
He squeezes his eyes shut.
I know that.
But if the mist and the goddess behind it is displeased, they are the only reason I can think of.
Why? They are also her daughters?
Yes, but the dead queens had their chance, Katarine. They had it, and the island chose them for extinction.
Inside, Katarine, the dead queens are silent. She can feel them there in her blood and in her mind, clinging to her like bats to the walls of a cave. Their silence speaks to her of sadness, old sadness and pain. Part of her would tell Peter to stop, to be quiet, and not to hurt them anymore.
They take care of me, she whispers. They care for me, and I owe them the same care.
She strokes her own skin, but for the mist to quiet, must she really let them go?
Perhaps, if they could be gotten out, if they could be laid to rest, that would not be cruel?
No.
Peter takes her hand and kisses it.
That would not be cruel at all.
The next morning, Genevieve comes to escort her to the council chamber. Peter has already gone, down to the library to try to find a way to exorcise the dead queens from Katarine. If he does not find it there, he will try the library at Greavesdrake. And if that fails, Katarine has given him permission to discreetly go to the temple scholars. He was so eager to be off and so pleased with her for making the right choice. He called her brave, good-hearted. Genevieve, what word have you received from Sunpool? When is the oracle to arrive?
I mean to address that in council this morning, Queen Katarine.
They pass by the open doors of the throne room, and Katarine glances inside. There is no one there except for a smattering of Queen's Guard. So few people come to her for governance that they are able to restrict them to certain days of the week.
Is something odd going on? Katarine asks. Should I not have sent Peter on that errand this morning?
Nothing odd, Genevieve replies. Or if there is, it is nothing that cannot be handled without my nephew.
Inside the Black Council chamber, everyone has already assembled. Even Bree, who has proven to be chronically late. When they see Katarine, they stand, and the mood in the room is so tense that she does not bother sitting down.
Tell me.
She waits, watching as the responsibility to speak passes through the room in sighs and shuffling feet. Antonin and Cousin Lucian look away. Bree pretends she has not heard. Only Ro and Luca raise their eyebrows, and finally Luca takes a deep breath.
There is an uprising in the north.
An uprising?
Someone claiming to be Jeuien Milone is traveling through the North Country, raising an army to rebel against the crown.
The words strike Katarine cold.
A rebellion? Fenburn does not have rebellions.
Perhaps this will be the first.
How do you know this?
Luca and Ro glance at each other.
Reports first reached us in Roland, says Ro. The rebels were supposedly seen there, to the west, and there have been rumors of Jules Malone as far as the villages south of Innisfool.
Jules Malone drowned with my sisters, says Katarine,
and every eye falls. They know as well as she what it will imply if the naturalist is found to be alive and well. Beside her, Genevieve clears her throat.
We think they are heading to Sunpool, and that is why the oracles have denied our request for a seer. They have allied with the rebellion.
The room closes in around Katarine until it is hard to breathe.
The Legion cursed naturalist is alive.
Or someone who is pretending to be her.
And the City of the Oracles has taken her side?
Katarine scans the faces of her council.
Who else?
Bastion City, perhaps, says Genevieve.
The Malone girl is calling herself the Legion Queen.
The Legion Queen.
the queen of multiple gifts, who will unite the island under one banner. If they only knew. It strikes Katarine as almost funny. The people yearn for a queen with a two-gift curse when they already have a queen with all of them.
So now I must fight a war for my crown and the mist as well?
She grinds her teeth.
And I suppose that the rebels are using that to their advantage, spreading word that the attacking mist is my fault?
They say it rises against you, says Luca. They are using it as a sign.
Katarine sinks into her chair.
Well, she says, you are my Black Council, my advisors. This is the part where you are supposed to advise.
I say embrace it.
Ro Mertra places her knuckles upon the table.
Wage a war. Use it to quiet the unrest. Nothing calms the people more than having something to fight against.
You would say that, Antonin spits. War gifted. Always spoiling for a battle.
And why not, if it's a winning battle? The Queen's Guard Army is in fine shape, despite languishing under soft poisoner leadership. It can rout a band of rebels made up of farmers and fishers.
Even if those rebels are backed by every warrior in Bastion City?
Katarine slaps her hand down, and their arguing ceases.
There is still too much I do not know. About the Mist, about the Blue Queen, and now about these rebels and Jeuien Malone, if that is indeed who she is.
She turns to Genevieve.
I need an oracle.
I told you, my queen, none will come. They have refused us.
They cannot refuse the crown, Katarine barks. Send the queen's guard and arrest one, and bring her back here for questioning.
She presses one hand to her cold belly, where she can feel the dead queen's beginning to quicken.
Then, we will know what to do.
The Black Cottage. Well? Jules asks, as she and Camden help Kara brew another of the endless pots of nettle leaf tea.
How bad is it?
At the counter, chopping herbs and trying to keep cougar breath from blowing them everywhere, Kara frowns. It's not good, Jules. Every day she bleeds, and every day it's harder to stem the pains. How long will it be before it's safe for the baby to come? Maybe it is not only the baby we should be worrying about. Jules swings the hot water kettle away from the fire and wraps the handle in cloth.
Don't tell me you believe that low magic nonsense.
Whatever you think about the rightness or wrongness of it, low magic exists, Kara says. And my sister has become the closest thing that the island has to a master of it.
Maybe, but this time she's wrong. Have you heard her talking about the baby? She keeps calling it he, a boy, when we all know that Malone women only bear girls, two girls.
The old Malone rule, Kara says softly. The old Malone curse. We have more than our fair share of those, don't we? Jules brings the pot, and Kara ties the herbs in cheesecloth and drops the bundle in. The nettle tea will be bitter enough to pucker Madrigal's cheeks, but Willa says that they cannot add even one drop of honey. We thought you were dead, Kara says quietly, or at least gone. And then Worcester came with strange news. The mist was rising without cause and leaving dead bodies in its wake. Rumors of a legion-cursed naturalist who would go to war. Kara narrows her eyes. I didn't believe it was you, of course. I thought it must be an imposter. But your mother knew it had to be true. How did she know? Jules asks. Perhaps she knows her daughter.
She doesn't know me. You know me. You raised me.
And then she raised you, says Kara, after I came here. She reaches out and tucks Jules's short hair behind her ear. You even look like a queen these days. Jules brushes her away with a smile.
I never thought we would get this far. Even when Mathilde's crazy story started to work and people started to believe. And then maybe I started to believe.
Madrigal would say, that is what destiny feels like.
How do you know what Madrigal would say?
She's my sister, Jules. Thinking she's dying has made her almost sweet. She's trying to make amends. So am I, in case she's right.
Kara looks at her meaningfully, but Jules just sticks her lip out and blows hair away from her forehead. The baby will be fine, and Madrigal will be up to her old tricks in no time.
She gathers a cup and saucer and assembles Madrigal's afternoon tea service, piling on a few of the almond biscuits she likes, the only thing that Willa will consent to her eating alongside the tea. Halfway down the sunlit hall, Jules hears Amelia's laughter bubble out from Madrigal's room. It is a pretty sound, and her unwell mother sounds in good spirits, laughing back. But for some reason, the fur on Camden's tail begins to puff with apprehension. When Jules enters, all is innocent. Amelia has just returned from foraging in the woods, her hands black with dirt, her burlap sack heavy with roots and herbs.
What did you find? Jules asks.
Big patch of fan root? Amelia reaches into the bag and pulls some out, a pale tuberous root, still attached to its bright green leaves, shaped like tiny fans, hence its name.
I will go out again after dinner.
Willa says it will keep well enough in the cellar. Before long, the frost and snow will get to the leaves, and it will be that much harder to find.
More fan root?
How delicious, says Madrigal sarcastically.
What brings you in to see my mother? Asks Jules, and Amelia shrugs.
We got on well together, after you left us for the queens at Barden Harbor.
Your mother understands the virtue of the war gift and the possibilities of your so-called legion curse.
Jules sets the tray of tea down beside Madrigal's bed. She pours some of the bitter liquid into the cup and points to it. Then she takes Amelia by the arm and pulls her out of the room and down the hall.
What? Amelia asks. What is the matter?
I know why you were in my mother's room.
Yes, I told you, because it is nice to converse with someone who understands our cause.
And because of the binding.
What?
The low magic binding. The blood. You know my mother bound my legion curse with her blood, and you know that if she dies, the war-gifted side will be let loose, which is exactly what you've always wanted.
For a moment, Amelia stares at Jules wordlessly. Then her eyes darken, and she steps up close.
I would never want that.
She is your mother. Have you forgotten that I had a mother who died?
No, Jules says quickly. Ashamed to admit that, for the moment, she had.
This war is everything to you. That's all I know.
She braces, sure that Amelia will use her war gift to shove her, to explode in her face. But instead, her shoulders slump.
It is not everything.
She turns and stalks off, and though Camden trots halfway down the hall after her, Jules cannot bring herself to.
Jules? Madrigal calls. Is everything all right?
Everything's fine. Jules returns to her mother's room and puts the neglected cup of nettle leaf tea into her hands.
Now drink.
Madrigal takes a sip.
You are a good daughter, Jules Malone.
A good daughter? Jules snorts. I've only been as good a daughter as you have been a mother. She looks at Madrigal, still small beneath her enormous, swollen belly.
Maybe we both should have tried harder.
Madrigal purses her lips.
Your friend Amelia is very fond of you.
Of course she is. I'm her pet queen, ridiculous as that sounds.
I think it's more than that.
Are you pleased? This is what you wanted, isn't it? For me to go to the warriors and learn their side of my gift, embrace some great destiny?
Her mother frowns at the tone that has crept into her voice. Jules had not